From the Sky News Centre at 6. The ash cloud above Britain will continue to cause problems for travellers well into the weekend. Ryanair has cancelled all of its flights to northern European countries until midday on Monday. British Airways won't have any flights out of Heathrow and Gatwick until at least 10 a.m. tomorrow. Volcanologist John Murray says the worst case scenario is pretty bad.
In 1783 there was an Icelandic eruption that carried on for 8 months, and that caused severe fogs. Everybody remarked on the sulphurous smell all over Europe.
A chief suspect in the kidnapping of five-year-old British boy Sahil Saeed has been killed in a shootout in Pakistan. Police say it happened after two men tried to free him from a police van taking him to court in Gujarat City. They were also shot dead. Sahil from Oldham was taken from his grandparents' house last month and released after a ransom was paid 12 days later. It looks like thousands of 11-year-olds in England may not have to do SATs tests next month. Members of two unions, the National Union of Teachers and the National Association of Head Teachers, have voted to boycott them. A final decision will be made next week. On last night's First Leaders debate on ITV, Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg said you have to let teachers teach.
What we want to do is to put onto the statute book an Education Freedom Act, which literally bans government from micromanaging what happens every single minute of the day with every single test in every single classroom in the country.
Prosecutors have been handed a police file over allegations against James Bulger's killer, John Venables. Venables, who killed the toddler in 1993 with Robert Thompson, was recalled to custody last month for breaching the terms of his licence. Footballer Ashley Cole is a surprise inclusion in Chelsea's squad for tomorrow's derby with Tottenham Hotspur. The England left-back has been out since February with an ankle injury. And the Rolling Stones are releasing a track that's never been heard before. Plundered My Soul is being sold as a limited edition vinyl single to mark Record Store Day, and a digital download version is available tomorrow. That's the latest. I'm Kat Higgins.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
And welcome back to Friday Drive Time. So, how did you think yesterday's US presidential style TV debate went? And are you looking forward to next Thursday's debate, which is being produced by Rupert Murdoch's Sky TV here in Bristol, at least rumoured to be taking place at the Arnolfini Arts Centre? And we hear also in the next hour from ex-Freemasons about some of the shocking secrets of their so-called craft. Also, environmental activists from London plan to set up a Bristol eco-village tomorrow at a mystery site. Why? And what is an eco-village? Also, we're discussing now something called the Bilderberg Conference, which is always quite an interesting thing. It's a meeting of kings and queens and some of the global financial chiefs, which takes place in a secret location somewhere in Europe and the United States. And I'm also joined by Martin Summers now. Martin, we hear that the Bilderberg Conference this year, we've just had a report, I think it was the middle of last week, that this Bilderberg Conference is taking place near Barcelona in Spain in the first weekend in June. What are your thoughts about the significance or otherwise of the Bilderbergs? I mean, I've written quite a lot about it, but I'm interested in what your thoughts are.
Well, the Bilderberg Group is one of an overlapping series of groups through which the oligarchy, for want of a better phrase, coordinates their policy. And as you know, Bilderberg for many years was secret, completely secret, and nobody knew where it was or who was being invited.
Just to be absolutely clear, oligarchy really means rule by powerful people?
Oligarchy means rule by the few, as opposed to democracy ruled by the many.
Okay, so it's really diametrically opposed to democracy.
Well, not diametrically opposed. I mean, in Aristotle's Politics, you've got monarchy, oligarchy, and democracy. So monarchy is when one person's running it, oligarchy is when a group run it, democracy is when everybody runs it. I mean, those are the ideal types. But we have a semi-democratic system which is effectively evolving into an oligarchy, and the Bilderberg Group is a key aspect of that oligarchic rule, if you like.
Now, it's event has been discovered by a journalist called Jim Tucker, who works for something called the American Free Press in Washington. And what he's saying is that the Bilderbergers, who are basically a financial elite, these are the people from the European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve. In fact, all the other banks in Europe, which aren't in the Eurozone, are also part of this group. Plus, you've got big players like the Rothschild family, several of which have been to the meetings, the Rockefeller family, which is one of the big financial families and oil families in the United States, as well as the kings and queens of Europe. We have Prince Philippe of Belgium, we have Queen Sophia of Spain, we have our own royal family have been to these meetings.
And the media, of course, top editors from the mainstream media.
Well, they're not
media.
Actually the editors that go. It's like Rupert Murdoch's chief executive of News International. These kinds of people turn up at these meetings. Now, I can remember going to the Bilderberg Conference in, this is in Brussels, a place called Jeanval, just outside Brussels, in the year 2000. And when we were talking to local journalists who turned up at the scene to tell them all these people were due to turn up, they just couldn't believe it. They simply said, this is some sort of joke, isn't it? But then, of course, when they actually did turn up the next day, the news round Belgium spread like wildfire, but only because we managed to speak to a guy who used to be the editor of De Morgen, which is a big Belgian newspaper, and he actually put a story on the front page of De Morgen on Saturday, and by 10, 11 o'clock on the Saturday, all the television from the whole of Belgium was there, the Flemish language television, everybody, and then the story just absolutely took off. But it does rather worry me that all these powerful people, particularly what with the current financial crisis, financially powerful people who control most of the money in the Western world can get together in secret like this.
Yeah, well, I think what's happened in the last few years, partly through the efforts of people like yourself, is it's no longer as secret as it used to be. And I suspect that probably what is happening is that from their point of view, the Bilderberg Conference is becoming less and less useful. And they may, you know, there are other organisations like the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and other more secretive groups. So they all overlap. I see Bilderberg very much as like a horse fair, really. The top financial people get together. It's basically their show. And they bring the politicians along to have a look at them and see their fetlocks and check their teeth and decide whether they want to buy them. It's like a gypsy horse fair with the politicians as the horses.
Well, they seem to also be very, very clever at inviting along secretary generals of NATO as well as national prime ministers, usually just the year before they either get elected to power
What usually happens is if you're an up-and-coming politician, like Tony Blair was, you get your Bilderberg invitation, like Bill Clinton, and your Bilderberg invitation is your, you know, your chance to schmooze with the financial establishment. Interestingly enough, somebody who was never invited and who never went is Margaret Thatcher. So she's outside the loop of Bilderberg. I think Bilderberg tends to have an agenda of Euro-Atlantic agenda. And they don't really, you know, the awkward politicians like Margaret Thatcher are somewhat excluded from that. But of course, she was included in lots of other discussions. So Bilderberg is not the only secretive group that meets, but it's a very significant one.
They were very much to do with, the Bilderbergers were very much to do with the formation of the EU and the formation of the Euro and the Eurozone and the European Central Bank. And one of the things that Mrs. Thatcher didn't like was this whole idea of handing financial sovereignty over to the European Central From their point of view,
she was a square peg in a round hole. But don't forget that the this is ultimately driven by the interests of US finance capital. So they're basically shaping Europe to fit their agenda. It's quite clear who's in the driving seat, and it isn't the Europeans.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. And I may even try and get down there this year to Spain that weekend and cover it, because it should be reasonably easy to get to. The other thing I would say,
as long as the volcano doesn't keep up.
Well, okay, we maybe go by train or ferry or something like that. But anyhow, the fun aspect of all this is actually hanging out with all the freelance journalists and sometimes from national newspaper journalists and photographers in the hotel, because we always pull information in the journalists' hotel, because it's obviously the Bilderberg Hotel itself, whichever one they've taken over, is absolutely staked out by security, but usually by the security service of the country involved. So it'd be like the Spanish version of MI5 or whatever that actually do the security. So you can't get anywhere near the hotel, despite the fact that sometimes the people who are at the meeting, who aren't necessarily big fans of the Bilderbergs, try and get out and chat to the journalists. So in the evening, you're able to really have a good talk about world affairs.
Yeah, they don't provide any facilities for journalists, do they? I mean, you're all there as freelancers. They're not handing out any press packs or anything, are they?
Well, one year we were stood outside the conference at the gate, you know, sort of just beyond, trying to take pictures of anyone going in and out. The Greek finance minister actually came out. She said the price of cigarettes inside the the hotel is so expensive, and also it's an oppressive atmosphere. I've got to get out. And he'd actually tried to smuggle out a list of the subjects that were being covered and the names of the people who are in there to us, but the security actually stopped him on the way out, went through his pockets and discovered that there was a list of who was inside the hotel and took it off him. So you can see that actually a lot of the politicians who are invited, bizarrely, are the ones who are more on the side of the journalists and want more openness at these meetings. But obviously the people who are organising it, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, etc., don't want that. They want absolute wall of secrecy around it. They use something called the Chatham House rules as well. I don't know what your thoughts are on those, because I mean I've several occasions been asked, this is a meeting where we're going to have Chatham House rules, and there's a kind of cloud descends over the meeting, as if, you know, we're not allowed to talk to anyone outside about what we hear.
Now, I think under Chatham House rules, as I understand it, what that means is that you can quote what people say, but you can't name them. So you can say, ah, source told me so and so, but you're not actually supposed to name them. All of this is very strange. I mean, I do accept that, you know, the movers and shakers need to get together and move and shake. That's what I'd do if I was in charge. I'd get everybody together and try and knock some heads together. But what's very sinister about this is the secrecy. Why is this secret? I mean, we all know about G8 meetings and so on, and of course the protesters turn up and protest. I mean, that's how democracy is supposed to work. But the Bilderberg meeting is kept secret. And, you know, if my politicians, like Tony Blair and Mr. Mandelson, are going to these meetings, I want to know about it.
Funnily enough, both of those two have been, yes.
Indeed, but I want to know about it. I mean, they're supposed to be representing me, and I want to know what they're up to. I mean, British cabinet ministers, I need to know I ought to be able to know what meetings they're going to and where they're representing me. Now, if they're going off to secret meetings, well, that's a bit of a problem, isn't it?
Well, I know the former leader of the Labour Party, John Smith, was just before he died, actually, did go to a Bilderberg conference, and he was very, very critical. He was saying that these people really don't understand economics, and it is a bit worrying when you get a little bit of insight like that.
Well, just before he died, John Smith gave a speech to the Socialist International in Geneva, which I quote in my book Market Failure, 1998, Pluto, in which she said, look, the IMF, the World Bank, and all of these institutions are going to have to be abolished because they've just become a menace to humanity. And then he died suddenly, soon thereafter. And of course, Mr. Blair was not the sort of chap who's going to talk about abolishing the International Monetary Fund, but John Smith did.
Well, the IMF and the World Bank feature very heavily at all these Bilderberg conferences, and I think if you look at the list of people who are there, actually our representatives, the politicians, are very, very much in a tiny minority.
Well, they are there, as I say, as the horses to be bought and sold by the real movers and shakers. I mean, this is the problem we've got. We've got a facade of democracy, so we're going to have a general election in a few weeks' time, but a lot of the decisions have already been taken by faceless people. We don't know who they are, we're all going to cut public expenditure. Everybody's kind of got this into their heads. We're all going to cut public expenditure. Well, somebody's told us that's what we're going to do, and all three party leaders are talking about it, and it's maybe that's just a suggestion, and that we don't have to do that at all if we wanted to do something else. But we've already been told that that's the policy. So why are we bothering having a general election if the policy has already been decided? And of course, this is the issue. This is the nub of the issue. The oligarchy subverts democracy. Aristotle understood this very well. Democracy is ultimately overthrown by the aristocracy. Yeah, it evolves into oligarchy because they get more and more power, and eventually they do become dominant. And we've got to rebuild democracy from the bottom up, and we've got to make sure that these people are accountable, because they don't want to be accountable, but we've got to make them so.
So how do you think the TV debates, this wonderful new historic thing, how's that affecting all that? Because it doesn't seem to me that that's really opening up the field for more democracy.
No, well, I mean, the problem is that the kind of topics that can be discussed are so circumscribed. Yeah, so you know, the agenda is already decided before we set off. So, you know, you've got to go within a certain consensus about what is and what is not feasible. So everybody, for example, is saying that the Icelanders can't just not pay their debts, and that's the standard position. But of course, in actual fact, the Icelanders don't have to pay their debts, and it looks like they're not going to. And we've got to break with the past and with the failed ideas of the past. But that, first of all, you've got to free your mind before you can do anything else.
Well, in order to free our mind at Bilderberg, there are two journalists that constantly turn up every meeting, and they are both from The Economist magazine. And of course, they write nothing in The Economist magazine at all about the Bilderberg conference itself. Well, they just do exactly what you've been saying, which is say, oh, we must have cuts, and this is why.
Yes, and also the other thing that's very annoying about The Economist, which I find very difficult to read, is there are no bylines on their articles. They're just handed down from heaven like Moses tablets, and this is the, you know, the Economist position, and this is what all sensible people are thinking, and we don't even know who's written this. So you can't write in and say, I don't agree with so-and-so's point of view about this, because there is no so-and-so to write in for. We know somebody's writing it.
Well, the right to have a byline, that is to say your name on an article, is a right that journalists have been fighting for hundreds of years.
Yes, the Economists go for this kind of tablets of stone approach. And of course, this is perfectly fits in with this, you know, this is what serious people think about. And of course, it does set the agenda for the serious people. They all read The Economist every week and they know what to think. But The Economist has been dramatically wrong about lots of things over many years. So there's no particular reason why they're any great expert on anything.
Thanks, Martin. Right. Sark is one of the smallest of the Channel Islands, which lies at the coast of off the coast of France near Cherbourg, which was the last feudal state in Europe until democracy arrived in 2008. But over the last few years, a quiet battle has been raging over control of the tiny crown dependency. The battle is between the residents and the Barclay twins, the new owners of an island just off the coast of Sark called Brecou. The Barclay twins are multi-millionaires who own the Ritz Hotel in London and 3 years ago bought the Daily Telegraph off of Conrad Black, who's now in jail. So, Martin, what is the story of Sark? Can you tell us something about its historical background?
Yeah, Sark, I visited Sark in September, and it's a very interesting place because it's not actually part of the United Kingdom, although it is part of the British Isles. So it's a very, very small independent state. It's got about a population of 600 and something, and they are an independent state. Until very recently, they were a feudal dependency of the crown.
Now, how does that work? How does a feudal system work nowadays?
Well, there is a ruler of Sark, the Seneschal, who's currently a chap called Michael Beaumont. And some of the listeners may remember that in the Second World War, the ruler of Sark was the famous Dame of Sark. And she had to deal with, of course, the Sark was occupied by the German forces during the Second World War, and she had to be a kind of buffer between the population and the German occupiers. So Sark's got a very unique history. And the Barclay brothers arrived in 1993 and bought the island of Brecou, and I think people in Sark thought, well, it's just another wealthy tax exile coming to live in Sark, because they've got quite a lot of people living there who are tax exiles, because it's not, you know, there's no UK tax in Sark. But since they've been there in 1993, they've been causing more and more problems for the people in Sark. There's been a number of legal challenges by the Barclay twins to Sark's way of doing things. So at first they bought the island of Brecou off the coast of Sark, and then they tried to claim that Brecou had never been part of Sark, and therefore they should be allowed to be independent of Sark. And the Sarkese just weren't having that, and it went to the House of Lords and it was overturned. There's another rule on Sark, which is dates back to the 16th, 17th century, which is that the eldest son must inherit all properties. This was in order to, you know, the idea was that a British garrison was on Sark, you know, in order to protect against piracy, against French fleets, whatever, and therefore you need to have a number of people who are, you know, ready to muster at a moment's notice to defend the island against intruders. So it comes from that kind of military history. But precisely because the Barclay brothers have attempted to control Sark, I think the Seneschal and the local people in Sark decided that they would move towards having a fully democratic system. And they did have their first fully democratic election in December of 2008. In that election, as you know, the Barclay brothers were not passive at all. They took a very active role in trying to get their employees elected to the new Chief Pleas, which is the Parliament of Sark, and then they tried to get lots of other people not elected. Yeah, so they carried out all sorts of propaganda in order to try and remove these people from the election, including one called Tony Ventris, who I believe you've got a clip of.
I'm Tony Ventris, member of the local Parliament. have been on SOC since 1969. The Barclays have come onto the island fairly recently through their SOC estate management and have done quite a considerable amount of good work in tidying up and redeveloping some of these sites that they've taken over. It's just a pity that the Barclays themselves turn out to be antagonistic towards the Sark way of life. They have not involved themselves in Sark. We don't see them over here. They then determine that they are going to tell us how we are going to run our island. And it has taken Sark itself over 10 years to re-evaluate its parliamentary setup, which came to fruition last December with the first totally democratic election, with 28 people elected to our parliament. At the election we had 56 candidates standing for the 28 seats. There were 9 people that the Barclays said must be elected, and then there was another 17 or thereabouts who they would like to have elected as well. When it came through, they actually had 5 of their people elected, and they took great umbrage at that, despite the fact that the turnout was in the region of 84% of the electorate, the majority of whom had voted for 25 of the candidates, which meant, of course, we'd had a very, very long counting session. And even so, despite this real example of democracy at its very best, they took umbrage and immediately pulled all their workers out. Their main manager over here said Sark has signed the longest suicide note in history. They then departed. But such was the furore that the press and the amount of support that the Sark populace got from the media, they very quickly backtracked and reinstated all their workers. But we have never had an apology for that infamous suicide note speech, which of course, you know, we would like. It's a great pity that even so, the Barclays themselves do not seem to have learnt that Sark is a unique sort of population where we are very small, 650 people community, and unlike a village in England, where if you can't get on with your next door neighbours or you don't like the restaurants or pubs that are around, you can always go 10-15 miles down the road and find something else. Here we have to live together. It is absolutely essential that even when we have disputes amongst ourselves, it's solved in a relatively friendly way, because we'll probably need that person a few days later. We're all of us totally and absolutely dependent on each other. It's a very dependent community, because I can't dash off and get another builder from, say, 20 miles away. I have to rely on the plumber and it's the electrician to come in when I need them. And I can't afford to fall out with them. I can disagree with them, and we do disagree with each other. The Barclays just haven't got that. They just don't seem to realise this. Their attitude is, if you don't agree with it, with us, we'll set our advocates onto you, our lawyers onto you.
That does sound, Martin, like a classic David and Goliath sort of struggle that's going on Sark. What are your thoughts about Tony Ventris there? And what he's saying basically is that rather than talking, the Barclay twins would much prefer to send their lawyer down to threaten to sue or to actually sue people.
Well, they've been very litigious with the government of Sark. They've also been circulating scurrilous rumours about individuals on Sark that they don't like. There's a whole propaganda barrage going on of character assassination. There's a short YouTube film which I've made about all of this, which people can find on the internet. It's the web address is www.quizlings.org.uk, or you could just search for it with a search engine for Who Rules Sark and my name Martin Summers, and you will see the short video that I made on Sark earlier in the year, last year.
So the current situation appears the Ministry of Justice has been looking into the governance of Sark, haven't they? I've got a short piece here from the Guernsey Press and Star from the very end of last month. The UK Ministry of Justice has been told to keep a watching brief on Sark after fears about Sir David and Sir Frederick Barclay's influence were raised during a Crown Dependencies inquiry. Members from the Justice Select Committee visited the island as part of its review into how the Ministry of Justice represented the islands. When we visited Sark, we were told of considerable economic and political power exercised by Sir David and Sir Frederick Barclay, the committee's report said. We were also told that the Barclays were engaged in a long-running battle of attrition with individuals, particularly members of Chief Pleas, that's their little parliament, whereby the Barclays repeatedly instructed their lawyers to write to individuals demanding retractions or apologies in order to protect their interests and reputation, the committee said. We were told that such legal action rarely comes to court because the islanders involved often cannot afford to defend themselves and simply capitulate. Sounds like a little bit like some of the planning battles that we were talking about earlier. The committee has not tested these allegations in evidence and did not want to take sides or make judgment on these issues.
Yeah, but they also said, as a matter of general principle, we note that in a very small jurisdiction there must always be the possibility that individuals wielding very significant economic, legal and political power may skew the operation of democratic government. And this is all in the Ministry of Justice report, 8th report of sessions 2009-10.
But what about the links to the expenses scandal? Because I think this was one of the most fascinating things I found.
I've got here in front of me an article from the Times of July the 12th, 2009. And the Barclay brothers, or rather the Daily Telegraph, which they own, was the main media outlet which was pushing the expenses scandal. There were other people looking into the expenses scandal.
Well, they bought the hard drive, didn't they? So they had the rights to it. Yeah.
And I'd just like to read a little... they bought the hard drive off a chap called John Wick. And I'm just going to read it. I'm not going to read the whole of the article. I'll just read some relevant bits from this article so that people get a flavour of what's being said here. It's from July the 12th, 2009, by Dominic Kennedy and Steve Bogan. John Wick, middleman who passed on MPs' expenses on why he fled the UK. And it says here, the security expert who brokered the leak of MPs' expenses secrets has said that he fled Britain fearing arrest for theft and stayed abroad until Scotland Yard announced that there would be no investigation. John Wick, age 60, an ex-SAS major, insisted that he was not just a middleman and was deliberately unaware of the identity of the mole who removed more than a million computerised Commons documents. Mr. Wick, a Tory fundraiser, also said that he had sought advice about the leaked documents from Lord Ashcroft, the deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, but he said that his attempt to reach the peer was unsuccessful. Mr. Wick that he said that he had been actively involved in the Conservative Party and confirmed that he knew Lord Ashcroft socially and had worked for him in the past. The disclosure will raise questions that the expenses leak might have been a political plot to destabilise Gordon Brown's government while at the same time clearing out Tory dead wood. Lord Ashcroft runs a target seats operation from within the Conservative Party's headquarters. Now, what we're looking at here with the Barclay twins and Lord Ashcroft are people who are complaining about MPs' expenses and the waste of taxpayers' money, but neither Lord Ashcroft or the Barclay twins pays a penny of UK tax. So it's not their money that's being wasted here. And it was very, very...
So they're both tax exiles of one sort or another.
Yeah, well, Ashcroft is a tax exile in Belize, and they're tax exiles in Sark.
And Monaco. I think they've got a place in Monaco too.
Now, what it looks like here is that at a moment when a Labour government was facing down the city, and we were talking about this in the first hour, what Labour governments ought to do with the city when the city is out of order, suddenly the politicians themselves haven't got a leg to stand on, because all of this stuff is being used in a quite partisan way to remove people, to besmirch the whole of the political class, so that the financial class, the people who really are stealing your money, folks, are forgotten about. And I'll just make a point that all of the investigation of MPs' expenses has actually cost more than they supposedly fiddled. There's another question, of course, especially for Conservative MPs, is it really feasible and reasonable, if you're a Member of Parliament, that you should do other jobs while you are a Member of Parliament? Because many MPs do. They're only part-time MPs, so they're getting a full-time salary to be an MP, which is quite a good salary, and expenses. But on top of that, they've got lots of other interests,
but I think
which they're pursuing.
Most people will say, Martin, that this expenses scandal has been actually enlivened the whole political scene. That most people who've read about this are really glad to hear the way that their MPs have been fiddling expenses.
I would point out that one of the reasons why MPs were so-called fiddling expenses is because they haven't had a proper pay rise in years, because it's a terribly politically contentious thing. And they were told, during the days of Margaret Thatcher, they were told, well, the way round this is we'll just give you a very generous expenses.
But isn't John Wick really doing a public service by getting this information out of the public domain?
Well, if it was a public service, why was he paid £100,000 to hand over these stolen documents? And he left the country because he felt that he might be prosecuted.
But he's put himself at risk, hasn't he, for us?
I don't think so. He was paid for this, and nothing has happened to him. What's actually happened is some quite reasonable people have been traduced in public, and we've gone through this Aunt Sally show of throwing sticks and brickbats at the politicians. Meanwhile, the City of London, the nameless, faceless ones, although we know the Barclay brothers and we know Lord Ashcroft, they have been basically soaking up taxpayers' money in the millions. We're not talking about £4,000 duck ponds, which in fact didn't actually get agreed. We're talking about a huge fraud against the British taxpayer, and this is what a confidence trickster would call the diversion. Yeah. So we're all getting very, very upset about MPs' expenses. Meanwhile, a real confidence trick is being pulled on the British people.
So anyway, where now for British democracy then? Because we have the election coming up.
This is a very good question. I mean, we've got to sort out the relationship between money and politics, because we've got a situation where money is calling the shots and politics is very much the second fiddle. And the real problem for all politicians is politics costs money. If you're going to have leaflets, if you're going to make phone calls, if you're going to communicate with the electorate, you need some kind of funding. Now, we've solved this in the past by having the Labour Party funded by the trade unions, the Conservative Party funded by big business, and the Liberals funded by wherever they can get the money. But in other parts of Europe, that's not the way it's done. In Sweden and Denmark and places like that, each political party gets a slice of a pot to spend, and that's all. They don't get anything else on top of that. We've got a situation where we're evolving towards a US style system where you've got to be a millionaire to think about running for office. You've got no chance whatever unless you've got a huge personal financial backing. So before Barack Obama could even set off to be a politician, he had to be a successful businessman, and he had to have millions in his pocket. And of course, somebody like that is being a successful businessman. What it means is he used his political career to fix various property deals in Chicago, which enriched him, which then set him off on the road to be a politician. And of course, he's one of the better US politicians. But all of them have to be paid for. And we've really got to look at this. Where is the money coming from? I don't think it's acceptable for the Barclay brothers or Lord Ashcroft, if he's not a member, if he's not a UK citizen, I don't think it's right that their money should decide what goes on in our politics. If they're not prepared to pay taxes in our country, they should just go away and stop trying to stick their finger in. Now, if they want to pay taxes, we'll then have a look at the what political donations need to be looked at. I mean, it's not satisfactory, really, for the Labour Party to be entirely funded by the trade unions. But what's the alternative? If unless we move towards some cleaner system, then people have to fight with whatever comes to hand. But I think there's something very sinister. I mean, the people in Sark that I spoke to in September when I was there, as soon as this expenses scandal broke, their view was that what the Barclay brothers were trying to do at a national level is what they've been trying to do at local level in Sark, which is to bully and intimidate and get what they wanted through character assassination of their opponents and using their wealth and their legal muscle. And they've certainly tried to bully the people in Sark. I'm glad to say that the people of Sark have not been bullied. The chief police in Sark is not controlled by Barclays acolytes, and Kevin Delaney, who is their chief steward, did not get elected to chief police. They said, well, why can't we put on the committee for development ex officio? And they said, well, no, he didn't win enough votes. So they were trying to just get him put on the committee anyway, even though he wasn't elected. And I think that what they're trying to do at national level is what they've been doing at local level in Sark. And we really need to look behind the facade of what we saw in the debate, the leaders' debate yesterday, and see who is paying the funding for all of these political leaders. Who is pulling their strings? And I understand that David Cameron has been out to Sark, to Brecon, to confer with the Barclay.
Oh, right. This is actually to the Barclay brothers' mock Gothic castle.
Yes, they've got a castle there, mock Gothic castle, which is also shown in the film, where, you know, they're there several weeks a year. And as long as they need to be for the tax purposes. And they helicopter in and out. But they also helicopter in and out their chums, like Lord Ashcroft and David Cameron. And we know that because the locals told us that they've been.
Crikey. Well, can you just reiterate, Martin, your video and how to find it on the internet?
Yeah, I mean,
what's it called, first of all?
The video itself is called Who Rules Sark? My name is Martin Summers, so if you did any kind of search, you'd find it on that basis. But the actual website, web address is www.quizlings.org.uk.
Thank you. Now, last night saw the first of the new US presidential-style TV debates that we talked about briefly in the first hour. And next Thursday, Bristol will be the venue for the next in the series of these 3 hour-and-a-half debates, which will look at international issues with the political leaders. Now, one thing missing from these discussions is some opinions which fall outside the policies of the 3 main parties, such as increasing rather than cutting public spending, nationalising the banks or railways or the utilities such as electricity, water and gas, or pulling out of Afghanistan, or decriminalising drugs, all subjects which are out of bounds amongst the 3 main party leaders. And the studio audience have been specially selected and instructed not to applaud or express their dismay in any way. Anyway, last week, Martin Summers on this programme suggested that these debates must not be run as if they were taking place in North Korea with a selected and controlled audience. So, Martin, what did you think of last night's programme, and was it a North Korean-style show?
Well, I mean, that's a bit of political rhetoric. It wasn't a North yeah. Korean style show, but I mean, there must be questions about how the audience is selected. If we're going to allow this kind of random selection of audiences, it's got to be done in a genuine way, because otherwise there's a potential for it to be fixed. And as you say, for certain topics not to be broached at all, because they're outside the consensus that people want to talk about.
Anyway, to remind us what was missing from last night, we're going to hear an interview on Sky News, who are producing next week's prime ministerial debate here in Bristol. And that is with ex-Labour MP, now Respect MP, who's now with the Respect Party, George Galloway. The interview was about the latest Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and the interview took place in July 2006.
Joining me now is a man not known for sitting on the fence. He passionately opposed the invasion of Iraq, and now he feels that Hezbollah is justified in attacking Israel. The Respect MP for Bethnal Green is in our central London studio. A very good evening, a good morning rather, to you, Mr. Galloway. How do you justify your support for Hezbollah and its leader, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah?
A preposterous way to introduce an item, and what a preposterous first question. 24 years ago, on the day my daughter was born, and I've just celebrated her 24th birthday, I had to dash to the maternity hospital to see her given birth from a mass demonstration in London against the Israeli invasion and occupation of Lebanon. Israel has been invading and occupying Lebanon all of my 24-year-old daughter's life. The Hezbollah are a part of the Lebanese national resistance, who are trying to drive, having successfully driven most Israelis from their land in 2000, Israel from the rest of their land, and to get back those thousands of Lebanese prisoners who were kidnapped by Israel under the terms of their illegal occupation of Lebanon. It's Israel that's invading Lebanon. It's Israel that's attacking Lebanon, not Lebanon that's attacking Israel. You've just been carrying a report of 10 Israeli soldiers on the border getting ready to invade Lebanon, and you ask us to mourn that operation as if it were some kind of war crime. Israel is invading Lebanon and has killed 30 times more Lebanese civilians than have died in Israel. So it's you who should be justifying the evident bias which is written on every line on your face and is in every nuance of your voice and is loaded in every question that you ask.
Right, you put your finger on the button, though, didn't you, when you said that Hezbollah was set up back in the 1980s in order to remove every Israeli soldier from Lebanese soil. As you said, it achieved that in 2000.
No, it didn't.
This is a setback.
No, it didn't. It didn't. This is a key point that you're concealing from your viewers. Israel was forced out of most of the south of Lebanon in 2000. It still occupies a part of Lebanon since 2000.
The Shebaa Farms area, which is subject to this latest UN draft resolution.
Thousands of Lebanese prisoners have been kidnapped by Israel. Hezbollah and the Lebanese government want them to be released.
I spoke just a moment ago to the Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman, who said that the three Lebanese who have been captured, perhaps you'd like to use that word, have been
Anna,
before
it's
a
not
judge
those. These are
and
not
been
the prisoners.
To a court of law.
Oh, please, have a slightly longer memory than 4 weeks. I'm talking about the thousands of prisoners taken during the 18 years of Israeli occupation, illegal occupation of South Lebanon. These are the prisoners that have to be released in exchange for the Israeli soldiers that were captured at the beginning of this wave of the crisis.
Can I ask you about a report that's in today's Sunday Telegraph, which showed that Iran has given Hezbollah long-range missiles capable of targeting any part of Israel. Iran, according to this Iranian MP who helped found Hezbollah, has also said that Iran has given the organization authorization to target Tel Aviv. Can you blame Israel for wanting to destroy those missiles?
But this is preposterous. America has given Israel missiles that can target not just every city in Lebanon, but every city in the Arab and Muslim world, including Iran. Why should America be allowed to give long-range missiles to Israel, including hundreds of nuclear missiles, but Iran
because
is
it's
not
given
allowed
it to a terrorist
missiles.
Organization.
But they're not a terrorist organization. Only in the mind of Rupert Murdoch's Sky and the Times and the Sun and the News of the World.
I'm going to stop
not
you
a
there,
terrorist
Mr. Galloway.
Organization.
Prescribed
it's
terrorist organizations.
Terrorist.
One man's terrorist
state.
Is yes, another precisely. Man's freedom fighter. We know that perfectly well.
Precisely.
In most people's eyes, they are deemed to be.
No,
they had a choice, didn't they? Let's understand this. They
no.
had a choice, like the IRA.
No.
To
they're nothing
take
to do
on
with
politics.
The IRA. Listen, Anna.
I'm saying they had a choice
to
absorb the idea of politics. They've got two Hezbollah cabinet ministers.
Anna, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. You are totally wrong in saying that in most people's eyes, Hezbollah are terrorists. In most people's eyes, Israel is a terrorist state. It's the fact that you cannot comprehend that fact that leads to the bias which runs through all of your reporting and every question that you've asked me in this interview.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you one question? I was relating to the IRA and Sinn Féin. They have decided to embrace politics. Hezbollah had the chance to embrace politics. They've already got two cabinet ministers.
About?
They're well respected
in
the south.
In politics. They are.
That's what I'm
the
saying.
People of the south
if you
of
listen
Lebanon.
To me, I'm saying they've got two cabinet ministers already. They had a chance to do that. Why did they need to capture and kill Israeli soldiers on the border? Surely that sets back
because
their ambitions to be a political force inside a democratic Lebanon.
Look, because Israel occupies their country and holds thousands of their compatriots as kidnap hostages in their dungeons. It's really very simple, except if you think only in a clock that goes back 4 weeks. If you know, and you're old enough to know better, that this origins of this conflict are not 4 weeks or 4 years or 14 years, but are decades old. You want people to think that the crisis started when the clock started ticking on Sky News.
No, I don't
the people
at all.
In Lebanon
I want
know
to ask you one. Yeah, I want to ask you one final question. Do you think that the 4 weeks that we've seen, as you mentioned, the 26 days of this crisis, has set back Hezbollah's ambitions? Not only are Israeli soldiers now over the border. Let me finish. Would you mind letting me finish, please? Not only are Israeli soldiers over the border in sizable numbers, but also their claims to be a good political organization to help a democratic Lebanese government with the Syrians who've also now left an independent state, that has also come to blows as well.
What a silly question. What a silly person you are. Hezbollah is winning the war. You can see it on the other half of the screen. Hezbollah is more popular today.
That was not my question.
Hezbollah is more popular today in Lebanon, amongst Christians, amongst Sunnis, amongst Shiites, amongst all Arabs, amongst all Muslims, than it has ever been. It's Israel who's lost the war, and Bush and Blair, for politically organizing the war, who've lost politically. This is a defeat for Bush and Blair and Israel. Everybody but you can see it.
Let me separate out that question then. Is it a setback, given that Hezbollah was set up in order to get Israeli soldiers off Lebanese soil, that there are now more Israeli soldiers on Lebanese soil than there were 26 days ago?
Well, they seem to be getting a good hiding on the other half of the screen that I'm watching. Maybe you can't see it, but I'm watching them getting a good hiding in the war. So if that's a success, I'm not sure what a failure would look like. The reality is that this conflict will go on. The United Nations resolution solves nothing, gives Lebanon nothing, gives the prisoners in Israeli dungeons nothing, and as Anne Cluid, my erstwhile colleague, was just saying, Israel has just kidnapped even more Palestinian politicians, cabinet ministers, members of parliament, and thousands of others held in Israeli dungeons, and this war will continue until the overall settlement is reached. That settlement must mean Israeli withdrawal from all occupied territory that it currently holds since the war in 1967, the release of all political prisoners, and a state for the Palestinians with East Jerusalem as its capital. No justice, no peace. You're not going out of business as a newscaster in Jerusalem anytime soon, believe me.
Well, as usual, you have prompted a huge email response both for and against you, Mr. Galloway, so we'll leave it there. I have to say that some people might find it offensive when more families are mourning their dead to hear you say that it was a bloody good hiding.
You don't give a damn. You don't even know about the Palestinian families. You don't even know that they exist. Tell me the name of one member of the seven members of the same family slaughtered on the beach in Gaza by an Israeli warship. You don't even know their name, but you know the name of every Israeli soldier who's been taken prisoner in this conflict, because you believe, whether you know it or not, that Israeli blood is more valuable than the blood of Lebanese or Palestinians. That's the truth, and the discerning of your viewers already know it.
That was George Galloway on Sky News from from July 2006, and he was being interviewed about the July 2006 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Now, one of the myths about Freemasonry is that it began in the late 1700s, but many believe that it's part of a much longer tradition and simply repackaged and tailor-made for the modern world. Controversy rages about whether people join Freemasonry to do good works in the community or simply for privilege and promotion. When discussing the craft, as it's called, the only really reliable independent sources are ex-Freemasons who've made their way up the ladder of degrees but have decided to come out. One documentary that's taken the trouble to locate several ex-Freemasons was recorded over 10 years ago in the United States. It's called Freemasonry: From Darkness to Light, from Jeremiah Films, and comes to the conclusion that Freemasonry is a religious cult based on Babylonian religion and sun and nature worship from the ancient Egyptian cult of Isis and Osiris. Anyway, let's hear from the documentary's presenter, Mike Mandel, who is himself an ex-cult member.
Albert Pike was Grand Commander of Scottish Rite Freemasonry in the 1800s. From his book, Morals and Dogma, "The sun and moon represents the two grand principles of all generations, the active and passive, the male and female. Both shed their light upon their offspring. the Blazing Star, or Horus. These Masonic authorities agree that the symbols of Freemasonry are occultic and derived from paganism. Occultic rituals and symbolism that are central to Freemasonry were tremendously significant to me personally. I had been deeply involved in the many facets of the occult, including witchcraft, for a number of years. Witchcraft is the religion of paganism. It's the worship of the sun god and the moon goddess in various forms.
I was involved in the occult for about 12 years.
Steve Warren was a practicing member of a coven of witches.
For me, that is, I was constantly on a day-to-day basis reading, searching, as well as practicing arts such as divination, getting in contact with the dead through mediums, tarot cards, crystal balls, everything that we would consider occult, I was involved in.
There's a great deal of symbolism in witchcraft itself. Many of the implements used have significance in terms of natural elements, such as the wand representing air, the athame, a sword representing fire, a chalice with water, and a pentagram representing earth. And these would be combined in various manners in order to take advantage of the spiritual forces that were felt to be in operation at that particular time.
And it was heavily ritualistic, with the wearing of robes, the drawing of magic circles, the invoking of gods to aid the practitioner, as well as just anything you would do, even if it was not in a formal ritual, always had something to do with ritual. Even if it was casting a spell, you would always light the candles, bring out the elements, set up your altar.
Some of the parallels between Freemasonry and witchcraft show such a similarity that it cannot possibly be coincidental. Similarities in ritual, wording, and symbolism are so close in several instances that it clearly suggests a common origin. To examine this possibility, I spoke with a number of former Masons and compared their Blue Lodge initiations with the experiences of former occultists.
In the initiation in Freemasonry, we had to be recommended by another Mason.
Well, in order to join witchcraft, you have to be first screened. You have to be recommended by somebody currently in witchcraft.
Well, when I was initiated, I was blindfolded and bound by a rope, and on your bare chest was thrust the point of a spear.
In witchcraft, we were initiated through a very involved ritual, initiation ceremony, wherein the candidate was led blindfolded, bound by a rope, to the edge of the magic circle.
And the rope is around your neck and you're led forward. And up front, in the eastern end of the building, is a person who's a worshipful master. And you kneel down before him as if he were a god.
You are met by the high priest or high priestess at that time, usually with a sword to your chest.
When I went to enter the lodge, a sharp object was put to my left breast. And I was warned that should I reveal any of the secrets of Freemasonry, to know what to expect.
When you're presented before the high priest, a sword is held against your chest and you actually take a blood oath, promising to remain faithful to the secrets of witchcraft.
Well, when you are in the room, this blindfold is taken away from you, and this is a time when they say that you're coming from darkness into light.
During the initiation ceremony, the initiate is led by the lieutenant of the high priest and is challenged at the edge of the circle by someone saying, "Who goes there?" And the answer is, "One from the world of darkness."
In Masonry, the prayers are ended with, "So mote it be."
Oh, and one of the other aspects of, or distinctives of the craft was that we would always end any spell or ritual where we released the power, this is where the power was released, with the word, "So mote it be."
And that was Mike Mandel from a film called Freemasonry, From Darkness to Light, by Jeremiah Films. Now, a London group has come to Bristol and plans to create a small eco-community. The group, called the Bristol Eco-Village Project, wants to do something about mistreated land and current ways of living. They will be living off-grid, which means not being dependent on the usual gas and electric services, and instead using raw materials such as burning wood for heat, light and cooking. This project is based on the success of their Kew Bridge eco-village in London, which formed in June 2009. Both these projects will be and are dependent on recycling and donations by integrating into the existing community to get people back on the land and create an environmentally and socially better community. Tim Harris, one of the creators of the Bristol Eco Village project, was in the Kew Bridge Eco site to talk about what and why and how the Kew Bridge project has been a positive inspiration for the movement. And he spoke to BCFM's Laura Cann.
Hi, well, my name's Tim Harris. I'm a member of the Bristol Eco Village project. We're trying to set up a urban centre for alternative technology in the heart of Bristol at the moment. An eco village is, most generally, it's a sustainable community that lives off-grid, off-grid meaning not plugged into the mains of any sort, no mains electric, and build everything ourselves, make everything ourselves, and just live as communally as possible, and it's as peacefully of nature as possible.
In terms of Bristol, do you feel that it's an area which is able to achieve that kind of thing?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think one thing we're doing different is that we're doing an urban eco-village project. Most eco-villages are done out in the rural countryside. We're in Kew Bridge at the moment, and this is kind of the first one of its types to be attempted in an urban environment that's succeeded as well as this. And outside of London, I think Bristol is the next logical place for this kind of movement to move to. The vibe about Bristol is just, it's just gagging for something like this at the moment. It really is. I love living like this. It's just such an amazing, positive way to live your life and to dedicate your life to. And there wasn't anything like it in Bristol, so I thought, well, what the hell, I'll set up myself.
Could you just explain a bit more about the Kew Bridge Eco Village itself?
It started off last June. I didn't come until a few weeks after it started, but pretty much it's just a group of people. We didn't have any skill, we didn't have any previous knowledge of how to live like this, but we decided something must be done. With peak oil coming up, climate change, all those kind of big pressing issues at the moment, we felt that there was a need to kind of try and create a sustainable community that reaches out to people. A lot of people say they could do it in the rural areas, but I feel that the work needs to be done in the city that will reach the most amount of people. Yeah. There's been a lot of different people have helped out with this community over the last 9 months or so.
Yeah.
A lot of people from the local community as well. I mean, it's definitely a community project. Community is at the heart of what we're trying to achieve for full integration into the local area. A lot of it has been done by locals, local generosity, giving stuff, coming out and helping out.
What kind of things do you give back to the community then?
Lots and lots of open days, community events. We have musicians coming down and playing, face painting. Obviously, there's a bit of a community garden vibe as well. They come and help out, hold like seed swaps, just things like that. Basically, it's just, so this is a community space which they can come in, they can use, mm-hmm. and we never close the doors. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing the amount of locals who will just come down as just friends, and they'll just sit and chat and have a cup of tea with everybody.
Yeah.
A lot of people, they've never been out of the city, they've never been in a rural environment, they've never experienced anything that's kind of like happening here. They just live in a tiny cramped box, day in, day out, kind of disassociated from the community around them, between their neighbours. And then they come down here and experience the really open community vibe we have in this place. It's just done some small miracles, I think.
What kind of things are going around on this site which didn't used to be here from the beginning, just say, like, what's been built? And
This site here, most of the structures we use are called benders.
Mm-hmm.
It's where you get hazel poles, you connect them onto pallets, you can put them into the ground, bend them over to create a dome shape. Mm-hmm. Then you put insulation blankets all over them and put tarps over them and put a wood burner inside.
That was Laura Cann there interviewing Tim Harris, one of the Bristol Eco Village project creators, who hopes to claim some derelict and misused land in Bristol and create an off-grid community. If you're interested in finding out more, you can join their Facebook group, which Tim has mentioned. Just type in Bristol Eco Village Project. The Big Swoop, as they call it, will be happening tomorrow, Saturday, 17th of April. There will be meeting outside the Hippodrome amongst fantastic sunny weather, as we're told by the weather forecast, at 11 a.m. That's outside the Hippodrome at 11 a.m. The land will not be revealed until you get there to claim it, and it will be appreciated if you could bring any tools to help with clearing the site, or even tea, coffee and snacks. If you want to go and help clear up, meet people and enjoy the movement, that too is highly recommended, and all are welcome, they stress. Find out more at bristol.indymedia.org. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time, each week here on BCFM 93.2, where via our Barton Hill transmitter, we bring you investigative reports and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a guest for a future show, please go to our webpage at thisweek.org.uk. And that will take you straight to this our page on the BCFM website. You can also email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest in the first hour, ex-leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council and councillor for Eastfield, Steve
Comer. Are listening to
Thanks
BCFM
also to our resident Labour pundit and Oxford economist, Martin
BCFM
Summers. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
Volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.